The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 20th of May, 2020. I'm in Cummins, here with Geoffrey Holman, alias Fox.
That's fine.
Thank you very much for taking part in this program. Can I just get you to state your full name, your date of birth, and your service number, please?
Geoffrey Andrew Holman, born 4848, and service number 4720135.
Just to start things off, to share a little bit of information about where you were from, maybe a little bit about your family life growing up.
Well, from a farming background, we moved into this district at Cockaloochee, actually, with mum and dad and two brothers in 1959. Dad had a 300 acres of country at Port Nolunga, got out of that, came over here to Cockaloochee. And so, yeah, had a farming background all of my life. Went to school at Port Nolunga Primary School till grade 5, and then back to Cummins Area School till year 11. When I went home farming, and have been basically farming ever since, with 2 years Nasho in the middle of it. I actually volunteered for National Service. And I mean, you didn't say anything about that when you went in, but you soon found out after you're there for a while that there quite a lot of blokes did, actually. And they said you never beat your chest and said, oh, I volunteered, because you'd be a bit out of place. But I'd had a bit of a family military background, with an uncle in the First World War killed, actually, and an uncle in the Second World War killed. And the army always intrigued me for whatever reason. And I had the situation where I could get into the army for a couple of years, having two brothers home on the farm as well, and not to interrupt things too much. So I thought I'd go away and get a bit of excitement, which certainly did that.
And what age were you when you volunteered?
Well, 19, I suppose. I was 21 in Vietnam. So,
can you recall how you were feeling at that point in time as a 19-year-old volunteering for National Service?
Oh, all good. I mean, I believed at that stage that we should have been there, and we were there to stop the flood of communism and all that sort of stuff. But of course, in recent years, I've realised that we should never have bloody been there, and we lost, basically, which is a shame. So many lives lost, and just for probably one of the saddest days of my life, when the North Vietnamese went through Saigon. I thought, well, what in the bloody hell was all that for? You know, just a waste of time. So that was sad.
Can you just talk me through a little bit of your training?
Oh, I went to Pakapanyo for recruit training. That made the eyes open a little bit. Then to Singleton for infantry training. Then got assigned to the reinforcement mob in Ingleburn. And so after Canungra, jungle training, I think I was in Vietnam. No, 8 months after I was actually in the army, so, or thereabouts. Got over there in March of 78, my mum's birthday. I thought that wasn't a real good birthday present for her. And then, luckily, I think I joined 9 Battalion, who were due to come home in December. Before that, they said to me, do you want to stay over in Vietnam and go back out in the bush again, or float home on the boat? And I thought about it for round about a quarter of a second and said, thank you very much, I'm out of here.
How
How was like coming from Cummins? You said it was 8 months from the time you signed up to when you hit the ground in Vietnam.
Mm.
What a contrast of environment. How was that experience? How did you feel?
Oh, well, I suppose, you know, going through all the training bit was sort of a fair introduction to it all. I mean, it was all a bit out of this world, I suppose, compared to what I was used to over here. But Vietnam, well, you heard a lot about it. And so when you got there, I suppose, same old story, when you're with other fellas, it's a shared load, so you get on with it.
Did you feel prepared?
Once I got over there and in the platoon, I didn't think that we were trained as well as we could have been. But lucky to get into a platoon, had been there for a couple of 3 months, whatever it was. And so that was handy to have. They knew a bit about it, so that was...
So that made it easier for you?
Yeah, any questions I had, they had them answers for me, so that was good. They were good model blokes, and they never felt not welcome or anything like that. I do think also that coming from the country, that the whole army bit was possibly that little bit easier.
Can you elaborate a little bit
more? Oh, well, I think especially with bushwork and everything, I think country blokes were a bit more comfortable out in the bush than what city fellas were. That's only, you know, I've heard other people say the same thing, but that's just the impression I had. I kept a diary for probably 9 months. It's interesting to look through. And I had some very derogatory comments about city blokes. Anyway, so be it.
Do you still have that diary today?
Yeah.
Mm. And how often would you like flick through it and reflect? And
oh, not very often. Actually, my daughter made a book out of it. Actually, that and letters I'd got, it was quite interesting. Yeah, so she did pretty well. She did it without my knowledge. My wife knew about it, and she got the diary to it. There's things in it that I'd forgotten all about, you know. So that was good in itself to read through it. Just little bits and pieces.
Must certainly trigger a lot of images and emotions probably as well.
Yeah, I think emotionally it's all sort of, you know, settled back there, and you have the odd dream, but that, everyone has them, so it's no big deal.
Have you found that people ask about your experiences very often?
Oh, inquire? No, I suppose I've probably told them during the course of time anyway. They'd know most things about it. People are always interested, and I've always said, if anyone wants to ask a question, fire away. Usually when the grog's been flowing, people will ask more. So, I mean, I suppose it's just one of those lifetime experiences which people have sometimes. It's a bit out of the ordinary. Yeah, it's just one of those things.
Do you keep in touch?
Probably four or five of them from Vietnam, yeah. Basically all from Vietnam, the mates I made over there, not many from a couple I did go all the way through with from recruit training to over there, not in the same platoon once we got over there, but same battalion. Yeah, so keep in touch.
Could you talk me through a daily routine, a day in the life?
Yeah, well, it was tactical, like, oh, you're fully tactical, but, well, you'd... always sleeping in pairs, whether you're in an ambush position or not, whether you're in a three-quarter defensive position. And then you'd do a clearing patrol around the edge. You're usually sleeping wet. Well, that depends whether it's the wet or the dry season, I suppose, but wet season, you're usually sleeping wet on the ground, of course. You had to spend a couple of hours behind the section machine gun on the sentry during the night. Which could be a bit daunting, especially when you're first over there, because it's dark as a dog's bloody guts, and couldn't see your hand in front of your face, and you're just going on basically sounds what's going to happen. And to the uninitiated, sounds in the jungle was pretty bloody, until you got used to it, pretty bloody daunting. All the wildlife and Christ knows what else. Yeah, 2 hours through the night, you're up. And then we'd be patrolling, basically, depending on where. I mean, we did a lot of operations in jungle. We did a couple of, one on the back of APCs, tracks. That was easier. riding around, it's wonderful instead of walking. The problem when you're infantry and out bush, you're carrying, you know, around about 100 pounds on your back, so that was fairly daunting. I think I've worked out in the last couple of years that, you know, being a farmer, I think I've worked fairly hard, done a lot of shearing. I know what hard work's like, but I think bushwork in Vietnam was probably one of the hardest physical and mental things I've ever done. And also bearing in mind it wasn't long, I think it was a month in the platoon and I became one of the forward scouts, so that was a bit harder too. It was just fucking hard work. And because with all this weight on your back and you're always sort of, you know, you're on the ball, of course, hoping you'd see them before they saw us, and mentally and physically challenging, you could call it. I remember when I got home, I put on, I don't know if you remember those red plastic knapsack fighters, they take 5 gallons, I remember, and I put one of them on when I got back and said to the old man, that's exactly the same weight as my pack, which went over my webbing and all the other shit. And I think that was 50 pounds, 5 gallons is 50 pounds, I think, from memory. Anyway, it was bloody heavy. And of course, the weather was bloody demanding, and as in bloody, you know, hot and humid. It's the biggest whore of a place you could ever bloody hope to be in, really. And of course, well, if you're out in the bush for most times, operations would go for 4 weeks. And of course, you never washed or you never did anything like that. And you had all sorts of skin problems and prickly heat and crutch rash and all sorts of things that just made life that little bit more, interesting.
You just mentioned previously you were a forward scout.
Mm.
Was that something that you put your hand up for, or was it something
I know that a spare Armalite was picked up in the section. I don't know how we got that, an Armalite, but that was a lot lighter than the standard rifle. And I thought, yes, I'll have that, thank you. And it wasn't long after that with a scout that we had went home, or I don't know what happened, he disappeared. And it was put to me, and I no doubt I would have been asked, or I know that I thought, I can't remember. I don't think I would have volunteered for it, but the fact that I had this Armalite didn't help me, because scouts always carried Armalites. But I know I was a lot more comfortable up front where you're the master of your own destiny rather than being behind where you never knew what was going on. So I wasn't concerned, I remember that, when it happened and became... And I was fortunate. I didn't stuff up, which, you know, it's so easy to do. So I can come back with a clear conscience.
How long were you in that role?
For the remainder of the tour. So it would have been about 6 months, I suppose, or thereabouts, yeah. And once again, I think coming from the country, you had perhaps that bit more, for want of a better word, bit more bush sense, I reckon. Not trying to pat myself on the back, but I think that's just one of those things. I became comfortable with it. Me and the section commander got on very well, and he said only recently that we made a bloody good team. And I said, yeah, nice to hear that. Mm. So, I was lucky.
What were the most important things as a forward scout that you had to be aware of, or the most important skills?
Well, you smell, because you could smell them. Hearing, of course. I'd be no good now. And just visually, what you pick up, whether there's, or in jungle, if there's any trees cut, what it's right, they've got a bunker system here somewhere, you know, or tracks too, tracks, foot tracks, if they were hot tracks, cold tracks. So visually, a hell of a lot. And the silly thing was that they didn't, well, the first thing I was told when I got into the platoon, this is how poorly trained we bloody were, you could argue. They said, send home to mum and dad for a pair of secateurs, which you needed just, if ever, you know, didn't matter whether you're a scout or not, you'd be, of a night time, you might have to snip round a bit so you could get in a position where you could sleep, you know, with saplings or shit or whatever. But scouting, you're sort of, you're always, operating with your rifle up here and your eye was over the foresight all the time, you know, wherever your eyes where your foresight was. And snip, 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 trying to get your way through. So that was hard going, just, you know, pushing your way through bush. Thick jungle was pretty, you know, pretty dense, which it didn't take long in lead section to get stuff. People have told you what the three sections in a platoon.
Can you talk through that?
Just yeah, to explain. Yeah, so each three sections per platoon plus headquarters, which is a lieutenant, sergeant and a couple of SIGs perhaps. And the sections were scout, section commander, machine gunner, number two on the gun and perhaps two or three other blokes with various bloody other shit hanging off them. When you're sort of out there, you look like a cross between a bloody pack mule and a Christmas tree, really, all the shit you had to carry. Yes, I was lucky. I sniffed out a couple of bunker systems before blundering into them, and bunker systems are dreadful things. They're very well camouflaged, and if you got into them and they're in there, very bad experiences I had with other people. But luckily, we managed to become aware of them before they become aware of us.
How did you discover those? Was it yourself that discovered those?
Yeah, this was when I was up front. It would have been smell, no doubt, smell. You would have been wary if we come across a track, whatever. Perhaps would have heard them, don't know. Can't remember, but we're lucky. Just good fortune.
Was there ever situations where you backtracked or didn't advance?
Yeah, at one stage, we stopped and knew they were there. And I remember me and a mate said to them, actually it turned out to be the end of our tour for the last 4 or 5 months, I can't remember what we had, Peter Cosgrove, you know, the ex-Governor General, as our platoon commander. And we'd aware of this bunker system and we pulled back a bit and me and another bloke said to Peter, what, so he and I sneak up and have a go at him. But he said, no. Anyway, pull back, bring in artillery and all that sort of thing. So usually we were fortunate in my experience where we never run into a long tan situation or a Coral or Balmoral situation where it's just all shit happening. Luckily, we always mostly saw them first. We never ambushed when I was with the platoon. And they didn't want to hang around. They pissed off. So, you know, we were lucky. Just good, yeah. A lot of good luck, the whole fucking business, yeah. Good luck more than good management. Got over there in March. I would have spent probably 3 or 4 weeks with the reinforcement unit anyway, sort of doing in-country training with them, and then so it would have been April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. Yeah, 8 or 9 months, whatever it was.
How long before you departed Vietnam were you aware?
You're always counting down the days, how much longer you had, so yeah, I think things would have been a bit tentative, you could say.
Can you give me any examples of humour to get through and to pass the time and to keep morale up?
There's a lot of black humour around. I mean, I remember one of my good mates who come from Port Lincoln that happened to be in our section. Before every op, he'd say to me, well, Jeff, he'd say, you're going to probably get a cluster of AK rounds like that right there, this operation. I said, well, thank you, Ken, that's very kind of you. I remember funny things that happened, like a bloke lay down and there's a bloody chomper ants are big, horrible ants amongst other many nasty things in the jungle. That was the other thing I should have said about jungle work, leeches, bloody ants, wasps, bloody snakes. There's a lot of wildlife to look at one way or another. I mean, the snakes, they're usually short little snakes like this big, hanging in the bloody trees, crates they call them. Remember one of the biggest scares I got was when there's a movement just far away from me when I was up front, and looked up, and there's this snake with its head that far away, you know, up in the tree. I leapt back quickly, and it just pissed off horizontally through the bush. So that was a bit of a fright, but normally they weren't, never worry.
Chomper ants, you mentioned, are they like inch ants?
They weren't quite that big, I don't think. But they used to travel. I remember they scared me when I was on the machine gun, when I was over there first, could hear this rustling sound. I was sure there's a bloody great snake about 10 foot long, about from me to you away in front of the gun, but it turned out as ants moving under the dry leaf falls. I just made that sound. So I don't think they're inch ants, but they're sort of, they could bite. But anyway, this bloke slept on a bloody bit of nest or whatever, and he got bitten on the hand, and his finger was that swollen up, it couldn't get through. If he was a machine gun, it wouldn't get through the trigger guard. He's in a bit of pain. We thought that was funny. The same mate was talking about getting rounds in the chest, and he got bitten by a scorpion, and that made him hurt a bit too, which is hilariously funny to the rest of us. I remember that sort of humour. No sympathy. You never know what you're going to see there, one way or another. But just little nasty biteys. And, of course, the jungle itself, some of it was very ferocious. Spikes and barbs. And there are also red rubber ants in rubber plantations. So they're bloody weld or, stitch a couple of three leaves together to form a nest about this big. And if you broke them off, they'd bite too. They're hordes of things, rubber ants.
December 1969 was when you finished up in Vietnam. Could you just kind of talk about how did it happen that you left? How did you get back to Australia, etc.?
We left Nui Dat. We were floating home on the boat on Sydney, which is good. A few blokes flew home, and I would have liked to have flown home too to get home, but I think it's 10 or 12 days it took to get back on the Sydney is probably a hell of a good thing for all of us to just wind down and relax and realise you weren't allowed to swear every second word of your sentence and all this sort of thing. We had a quiet time in Nui Dat, the Dat as we called it, probably for those last couple of weeks. I don't think we had to go out at all, outside the wire that was. And trucked down to Vung Tau, which is about, I don't know, 40, 50 k's away, and got on the boat, and away we went. And it was very relaxing. Big can per man per day, you're allowed. And of course, if you did your sums right, or if you worked it well, and if you could get three or four, and a few of us had wind our way up to the front of the boat where those the bow, where those two holes where the anchors would go out, just sit in there with the tropical air coming over us and sitting back, drinking these, I think they're Reese's Pilsner, big cans, silver bullet cans. And I remember them as fine drinking moments. To know the whole thing is behind us, basically. And then, as it turned out, we're fortunate, 9 Ra was based at Woodside, before going away, and we got off in Adelaide, so marched through Adelaide. I felt pretty good then. There wasn't any demonstration, so that was positive. Yeah, so it was a good time coming up.
When you returned back to Cummins, I mean, did life just kind of then just resume as it was before for you?
Because I was over there fairly early in my time, and I still had 6 months to serve in the army when I came back, or thereabouts, and had to go back to Enoggera, where 9 Battalion was reforming. And that was just a complete waste of bloody time. There's probably 7 or 8 of us in the same situation, all private soldiers. We're the only ones with ribbons. No one else had ribbons. They all hated us. The bloody officers hated us. They didn't want to know any of our experience. I was very disappointed with that. In fact, the CO made us take our ribbons off towards the end. I mean, mind you, our attitude mightn't have been very good either. We might have been a bit slack-arsed. But I didn't enjoy that. I thought it would have been worthwhile. I thought I might even get a stripe. Might be able to, you know, help train the new fellas, but they didn't want to know us.
Why was that?
No idea. It was jealousy, crass stupidity. I just don't know. They had their little book that said, no, this is how we do it. And we weren't. Didn't feel welcome at all. So that was that. Anyway, so be it. So then at the end of that, home, back into farming, and the wonderful thing about this district was, and the RSL, the old fellas, they'd given us a farewell before I left. Welcome home, shook us warmly by the hand, gave us a badge, said, come and join us, young fellas. And of course, when you're 21 and a bit loose, as nice as those fellas were, I mean, they were old, they were 45 or 50 years old. And I didn't sort of get to the RSL as regularly until later on when I'd settled down a bit and got married, and you know, when I probably was 29 or 30. But the old fellas were totally welcoming. You hear all these other stories, and here it was good, and the district was good. I mean, everyone knew you'd been, but they never bothered us. I had a couple of interesting conversations with a couple of left-wing teachers socially about Australia's involvement and everything. I mean, at that stage, I still thought we should have been there, but although I don't know, because that's another big question. But the district was warm and welcoming. Couldn't be better. And still, they remain that way. I mean, it's very respectful of the fact that we've been away, and I mean, it's no big deal going away. A lot of people did it. But the district very respectful.
The branch here, how many members are in the branch now?
Oh, so only three as it is returned members now. We buried the last World War II bloke probably a couple, 3 years ago now. Funnily enough, after being not going to the RSL at first, up too busy rantanning around, but I did take over from the old fella, Ern Heath, had been president for 25 years, and I took over from him and turned out doing 25 years myself, as president. I think in that time I buried 27 old fellas, or had to do the RSL component of the funeral. So that was sad, because I said they were just lovely blokes. So now we're very short of numbers. We've got a couple of young Afghan veterans, but I mean, they're only 25, 26, and same thing there. They don't want to be hanging around a lot of old bastards. It's amazing how the circle goes around.
Mm, mm.
And, you know, in due course, they'll perhaps become more regular members, but I don't expect them to, and when they do, there's only two of them. So, and see, we're all in our bloody 70s now, the other three of us. Couple of affiliate members, so we're just marking time, you could argue, which is fine, and that's the way it goes. It's, and I'd hope that when it does shut down, which it will one of these days, I've always said if we had got, unless something unusual happens, another 4 or 5 years, we won't be an active group or a regular meeting group. And but the district, I'm sure, will still have a observe Remembrance Day and Anzac Day and everything, and to me that's all you can really hope for.
Do you feel that your time in service has helped you with farming life in any way?
I think the experience gave me confidence. I always think, well, shit, if you can handle that sort of shit, you can handle anything in civilian life, very basically, because and as I said, we're lucky that they always buggered off. I mean, very early in my tour, we were having a dreadful time in a mined area. Bloke behind me trod on a mine. Another couple of blokes in a mine incident, one killed, and a good mate badly wounded. You know, seeing shit happen and badly mutilated bodies sort of always sticks in your mind. But knowing that I'd got through a fairly significant physical and mental experience, I think, has been good in years since. And at times, if I'm feeling, for whatever reason, any degree of low esteem, I sometimes think, well, shit, hang on. You know, you did lead 20-odd blokes through Tiger Country without any mishap. So, you know, things aren't so bad now. And it's handy to look back on that and give yourself a bit of self-esteem, I suppose, if that makes sense. Met some bloody very nice blokes who I still keep in touch with. I was very lucky. It's my time as scout, and in that we didn't have any real bad contacts and they always pissed off. Went within a millisecond of shooting one of our blokes, you know, when he wasn't, there's a stuff up, and we mistakenly walked into another of our company platoon's ambushes, and all of a sudden this bloke, I was up front paralleling a track. No, we're following the track, which we shouldn't have been doing. Anyway, this figure just leapt across the bloody track in front of me. And in the millet, because, you know, when you're up front, finger on the trigger, safety catch off, ready to roll at the minute. And just in the split second before I pulled the trigger, I just happened to recognise his profile. But he's about 10 or 15 feet away, whatever it was. And I always thought, well, thank Christ I bloody didn't do that. Or one, because within an ambush, and I found out later on that if I had pulled the trigger, they would have pulled the claymores and I would have been arse over tit and dead anyway, plus three or four blokes in our section. So I was very lucky, you know, it was just good luck. Probably more good luck and good management.
Geoffrey Holman, thank you very much for sharing your stories with us today.
Oh, pleasure. Chris, see you.
You have been listening to the RSL A Time to Celebrate, 2020.